Well, yeah, but I'm okay with bailing out, you know, companies of 10. I'm not okay with bailing out Boeing. That's, you know, the difference there.
I think that any policy that is focused just on response on the ground today doesn't do it good enough justice for the type of crisis we're looking at. I think in a way it is a dress rehearsal. It is very serious in its own right, but it's a harbinger of potentially things to come.
What up, world? How's it going, everybody? Welcome to episode 109 of the Ameripodcast. We made it. Here we are. Hey, if you took the 9 and the 1 and you added them together... Never mind, that's not great a good tip. Fact. Go for it, John. What's our fact of the day?
Do other people do that too? I totally do that. When you see a sequence of numbers and you try and see which ones you can combine to put into 10. Does anybody else do that? You know, a good way to practice math is when you're driving around on rural roads, add up addresses in your head or do mathematical functions with the address numbers.
Sure.
Good way to keep your mind busy.
Yeah, you had me until that.
Keeping yourself sharp makes sense.
Yeah, no.
What's the fact?
Good stuff. Okay, so my fun fact for the day. Do you guys know the most heavily produced aircraft of all time? Fighter aircraft of all time.
Isn't that, you know, isn't it like the, it's the Mach something. I know this.
Nope. Well, you could take a guess.
The Hellcat Super Bomber 109.
You had almost it.
Is it Hellcat?
It's actually
a Hellcat? Is that right?
No. It's the Messerschmitt 109. It's a Nazi plane.
Ah,
really?
Goddamn Nazis. So they had to produce a lot of them because a whole bunch of them got shot down.
Yeah.
So, yeah, bummer for them, especially during the Battle of Britain. A lot of them were shot down by the Spitfire, which is an excellent plane.
Right there over the channel or over northern France.
Hell yeah. Turns out having radar helped.
So you're saying that these planes weren't made recently. They were made 50 plus then years ago.
So they're
not made anymore. That's for sure.
No, they're not made anymore. But they had a very long lifespan. They were used by lots of other countries. They first saw their first action in the Spanish Civil War. In 1936, I believe. And then a whole bunch of other countries used them, I believe, into the 60s.
Mm-hmm. A bunch of them were sold off after World War II ended and Germany was basically partitioned.
Yeah.
Because they couldn't have an army. So the Russians actually sold a lot to other, like, Cold War satellites of theirs.
Yeah, the Soviet bloc countries.
Yeah.
And they were ended up being used, I believe, at least I read on Wikipedia.
Then it's got to be true.
Exactly. I have degrees because of that. It was the basic model of the Messerschmitt was used. The Messerschmitt 109 was used for sports cars, which is basically like sleek body, super powerful engine. Let's rock and roll.
Wow.
So were there like 109 of these produced then?
There were, according to the article I read, which was how it works, I believe, 33,000 ended up being produced, which is a fuck ton. That is a fuck ton of these planes.
That is a fuck ton.
Yeah, I'm not up to date on my World War II history in terms of military preparedness and production, but
hardware.
I would be interested to see how that compares to, like, you know, like the B-29 bomber production totals and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But that's for another podcast. We don't need to jump into military history.
There's actually a great book called The Storm of War by, I forget his name, but it's really good, and they go into a lot of that. And you know, it's another interesting fun fact that does not have anything to do with a number. Hitler had an amazing fucking memory for military hardware facts.
Huh.
He just could boom, 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 just cite all of these things about equipment in other countries, in Germany, etc. And a lot of people took it to be that he was intelligent. And it's like, Yeah, but like kind of in an idiot savant way. And
sure.
In terms of strategy, he was a moron in a lot of ways, military strategy.
Oh, wait, you shouldn't fight a war on two fronts? I heard that you always should. You should try to spurn your resources as much as you can to both borders.
Don't start a land war in Asia.
Yeah. Huh.
Don't start a land war in Asia.
Yeah. And I want to be totally clear that we are in no way supporting Hitler whatsoever. We believe that he's an idiot savant at best, if not just an outright asshole. That's what I think.
Yeah. You can say like this person was effective at a thing and also realize that he should die a terrible, horrible. Well, I don't even want to say that. Just maybe he should be like erased from
history,
the computer simulation. Mm.
That's another deeper discussion. That's another deeper discussion.
And with our fun facts, as always, so informative and sometimes life-saving. John Anderson, Evergreen, Colorado.
Cheers.
Drinking the blue juice.
I felt like that was an informative, a cooperative fun fact.
Yeah. Cooperative because it didn't involve 109, yet it did involve 109.
Well, and everybody contributed.
Right.
We had a whole discussion about it.
Which interrupted
our introductions.
Just like last week's discussion on 108. Go back and listen to our 108 discussion.
Yeah.
And suggesting past episodes, which is always entertaining, Mr. John Kelly in the suburbs of Denver. How are you, sir?
Oh, I'm doing well. Nice sunny afternoon on another quarantine day. Wish I would have been outside a little more, but, you know, that's okay. John, what's in that blue drink?
Yeah, what is that?
Gatorade.
Just Gatorade.
Gatorade.
On the rocks?
Gatorade. On the rocks, baby.
Wow, classy. Classy and sporty. A little bit of both.
I mean, that's where we're at in quarantine life. So.
Not bad. Not bad. And I am your host, Mr. Balak Emanuel. I'm just kidding. It's Blake Mannion.
Nope.
That should be your chef name.
Yeah. My iron.
Oh, no. It's Blake Emanuel from now on. It has been decided.
You guys, I've been watching so many cooking shows relative to previous years.
Ain't nothing wrong with that, John.
That's another podcast. You just, Mignon, you remind me of steak. Mm.
Well, Blake, you are a prime A cut of meat, my friend.
Hey, thank you. I appreciate that. A good cut recognizes a good cut. But shall we enter on to the main course?
Wow, yes, let's do that. I am hungry for some of that.
For today's main course, we have, drum roll please. Policy, yeah.
May have been the most exciting policy announcement ever. But
it's all about the buildup.
Right.
I love policy.
Yeah, we thought it would be a good idea for you listeners who are following or maybe not following. Maybe you've heard that Bernie Sanders has suspended his campaign, making Biden the presumptive, thank you, John, candidate for the Democratic Party for president. So we thought we'd do something fun and give some policy ideas that we'd like to see Biden pick up that might be able to bring more people into voting for him.
Slash mm-hmm. be good for the country.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Should we start with Tyler's?
Yeah, so Tyler, Mr. Gorilla, couldn't make it today. He's doing top secret stuff. But we do have his policy suggestion. So, Tyler's policy says he wants to abolish ICE. He says this would help in terms of the pandemic because obviously the camps are a breeding ground for disease. Thank you, Mr. Grillo. From, where is he again? Oakland, California. Okay.
I think it's San Francisco. Or San Jose?
San Jose.
Right, yeah. Big Sur.
Marin County, maybe. I don't know. Something like that.
Eureka. Oh, wait. No, wait. Isn't that in Nevada? Or no, there's one in California too, right? Yeah.
There's Eurekas everywhere.
Oh.
Yeah. How do we feel about that?
I mean, I think that's a solid suggestion. You know, I honestly can say that I haven't followed the news about what's been happening in the migrant camps as closely as I have other news currently. So I'm not sure what the rate of infection looks like. But just from a public health perspective, jamming that many people into a crowded space with poor conditions is a breeding ground for anything. And certainly the pandemic would make it worse.
Well, and also, this is going to be interesting coming out of the pandemic, but we live in a global market, essentially. And we have global economics. And if that's the case, then countries' abilities to compete with each other are largely based on the population, right? How good your populace is, how smart your populace is, how good they are at starting businesses, inventing new technologies, etc. And when you have refugees, like we're seeing, a lot of these folks are extremely resourceful people, and they contribute to the economy once they're here. And so it makes opposite sense. It doesn't even make zero sense. It makes opposite sense to throw all of these people into camps and then pay for their room and board and not have them contribute to society and then end up becoming like massive vectors of infection. And another kind of infection, which is hate, which is something that does bad things to societies. So it makes no sense. We should be welcoming these people. And we should be helping these people. We should not be like throwing them in camps and treating them in inhuman ways.
Yes. Oh, agreed. And just to add a kind of real politic look at the election coming up too, that abolishing something like ICE or adopting that policy platform could help Joe Biden wrangle in some more of the Latino vote, which is usually more of a conservative voting base. A lot of them are Catholic or Christian, and so might pull in some more people to vote for Biden as well.
I wish Tyler was here, because I don't know if the purely political calculus makes all that much sense for this policy. I think that it at best is a push, because I think that it will mobilize as many people on the right as it will mobilize on the left. And I think
that's a fair assessment.
Also, yep. In terms of the policy, I think is too narrowly focused, I guess I would say. I would like to see immigration reform comprehensively and then have ICE, quote, be abolished, and we need some kind of government agency to deal with immigrants, but it should be, instead of using a police model, it should be a healthcare model. It should be a care model, right? So fundamentally changing the mission of ICE, to me, like dropping the enforcement and adding care or something like that would be the way to go. But I think if I was like running for president, I would say I am for comprehensive immigration reform, in which we have like sane human policies that work for our economy, instead of saying my immigration policy is abolishing ICE. Now, that's why I wish Tyler was here, because he cannot answer any of those criticisms, and I'm sure that he would have lots of good criticism or lots of good answers for
right
them.
Right. I think we're just trying to cover all the bases of what he was probably thinking about.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I would maybe on episode 110 we can have that discussion. Mm-hmm. Although we did have an abolish ICE discussion, in which I think we brought some of that up, and that was many episodes ago, many moons ago.
Yes we did.
I think that was AOC. That was like probably in like 2018, like around the summer of 2018, something like that, maybe.
Yeah, it sounds about right.
Yep. Who would like to go next?
I'll go last because I have a list.
Oh, that's fair.
Can't right. choose one. So, Blake, you want me to go next?
Let's rock, paper, scissors for it. You ready?
Oh, yeah. Let's do this.
Rock, paper, scissors, shoot.
Oh, Block A wins.
All right.
Blake, do you kick or receive? Yeah.
Shit, I don't know what that means.
Just pick one.
I'll go.
Yeah, do you want to go? Okay, go ahead.
That means you're going to receive.
Also, by the way, rock, paper, scissors, great medium for radio.
Yeah, no, totally. We're killing it. It's like we've done over 100 of these.
So I have an extensive idea here. It's not really a policy idea. I suppose it could be. because the policy idea is tied to the concept overall. So the policy would, I guess, be the UBI, the Universal Basic Income.
UBI.
So that's the policy. I'll start with that. But essentially,
can
I think
I make a prediction?
Sure.
Are you about to like reinvent communism?
I don't know.
we'll make that decision later on. Go ahead, Blake.
Okay, that's my prediction.
So this is my thought. The concepts of the UBI, or the policies of the UBI, but I also came up with the institution to back it up, I guess, which I think needs to be implemented as well. So in tandem with the UBI, we should establish a postal banking system and have the banks basically deliver and run the UBI. Each you know place would have the, each city would have their post office. That post office would work under a local. We'd have to establish like more of a local center for banking and mail, or expand ones that already exist. And then each one of those centers for the state would work under the Federal Reserve in their district. So that's my concept, and I came up with some like pros and some cons, I guess. But I think that if you had the UBI, and I'll get to how this ties into COVID, but you know, there's obviously an issue with predatory lending. And so instead of, let's say you needed a little loan to get by, you could pull that out of the post office and have your UBI pay for it when it comes out of your next month. So whether that's business loan, a personal loan, whatever you need, I suggest that like within the first 5 years, if your income exceeds a threshold, you don't gain access to the UBI. But after that 6+ years, probably a UBI for everybody. You could have an option to defer your UBI to taxes. You could have an option to...
We're packing a lot into this policy right now, Blake.
Yeah.
No, I'm into this.
Yeah.
I'm doing research as you're doing that. I'm reading.
So you generate the funding for the UBI based on the revenue that the bank would make, which is actually, you can get into some pretty serious revenue, especially if you did this widespread throughout the country, and then using the Federal Reserves.
But question. But they'd be coming from a post office style bank that was centrally controlled by the Fed. There wouldn't be private banks. There would be a post office type bank that was controlled by the Fed.
This is, I think, in addition to private banking.
So so private banking wouldn't go anywhere. You could still privately bank.
This is...
Good, because I thought you were saying that we're going to do away with all sort of private banking.
No, banking
and all money was going to be just controlled by the
absolutely leave the private banking as an option. You would just and this is obviously going to take some capital to renovate local post offices and get them set up with the right equipment and training and staffing, and then also to operate under like the more the centers for the postal and the banking services. This is like a full operation. It's going to also create a lot of jobs.
Say something? So I love this idea, number one. And number two, I think postal banking is slightly confusing as a term. And like, honestly, I'm doing a little Googling right now because this is an older-ish idea.
Right. Not new.
And so I had to catch up a little bit. But I think it's better to say this is basic banking services administered through the government to people who need it.
Right.
And it just so happens that the best way to do this is probably through post offices, because post offices exist everywhere. One of the great advantages of this is that it helps rural areas. And that's another reason why you want to tie it to post offices, because rural areas are already serviced by post offices.
So, and as far as like how to get people to use this service, you could say that if you want to have access to your UBI, you'd be forced to participate in the census once a year. You know, and you could walk into the post office and fill it out there. But also,
could you also tie voting to that?
Exactly. So at the same time, you could simultaneously register to vote and vote. But it's kind of like, it's a little center. Like the post office becomes a place where you can pick up a check in the mail, pick up some groceries if you had to have them sent to you. It relieves stress on that note from like delivery services that the post office is already overwhelmed by, you know? And a lot of this can be immediately accessed via internet and then printed out and handed to you over the counter instead of mailing it back and forth. So just, I think that would free us up a lot. Now we can get into how this affects COVID.
Sure.
So I was reading for you guys that little fact I learned the other day with the nonprofit about businesses facing the reality of going out of business in the next 6 months if the economy doesn't have a good bounce back. 43 to 51% of businesses believe that they have enough revenue or income to sustain business for the next 6 months, but they're not positive they'll be able to stay open after that. So what that means is that if the economy stays in this direction for the next 6 months, those businesses, 43 to 51%, could possibly be going under. That was kind of how I was like, okay, well, how do we help the economy without overwhelming government services, which is exactly what's happening right now? You know, everyone's filing for unemployment and money's not going out on time. Everyone's waiting for the stimulus check and all these people are out of work because their businesses went under because no one's buying their food. You know, well, what's the issue? It's just money, you know? So with the UBI, you could cover people and then you could have businesses apply for universal basic income even, you know, as far as like bailout money or to sustain operations to pay employees so they don't have to claim a UBI. You know, there's all kind of options.
I think that muddles things a little bit.
It could.
But
yeah, I agree. I think that once you get into people using a service that would help disadvantaged people, poor people, people that don't have a job, and then bump it up to private organizations being able to then use it, now we're getting into a different style of what you might call a social safety net or what you might call benefits for certain groups of people.
Look more so like a bailout.
I think it does muddle
like
it a little bit.
Stimulus bailout.
Well, yeah. And the context is a lot different, you know, like what kind of infusion of capital a business needs to survive is different than what an individual and a family needs to survive.
Correct.
And so, you know, you might as well administer it differently.
Well, and that's why the priority would then definitely be the Postal Service Bank. With the UBI being obviously, like, once that system is creating revenue, you can use that towards the UBI funding.
Yeah, so. Or maybe you could even use the UBI as like the capital infusion, and this is starting to get out of my economic understanding, but you basically infuse the capital of the bank with the UBI, and then that's how you do the funding, and then you get the bank going that way.
Sure. I don't know how you'd start it, but
yeah, it would clearly need seed money. I like the idea. I like the benefits that could happen for people who are in need, especially in rural areas like John had talked about earlier and Blake you mentioned, in communities that are really hit hard by economic turns when they're very heavy. I think that that's a great idea, especially when a post office may be one of the few buildings that they actually have in the surrounding rural area. So it actually makes perfect sense to establish something in a center area like that. It's usually in a central part of town that everybody can get to. I would be a little concerned with it overall, just when you talk about revenue generation through the post office to then fund the UBI, because not a lot of people use the post office currently. So, I mean, basing that completely off of revenue generation capabilities by the post office may be a little rough, but I mean, to implement something like that, you would likely need higher national taxes for people that, and then you could then put money in from the federal government into those programs. So I would be concerned about tying it to revenue generation, but that, I think that's my biggest concern with it.
I mean, I like the idea. There's a little graphic on Vox of what you could do at a, you know, for postal card, banking card, basically. And it's, you know, make just like a credit card, you could make online or mobile purchases, loan cash or fund onto cards, pay bills online, withdraw money at ATMs, transfer money internationally, take out small loans, and conduct mobile transactions. And so it's just a way of kind of like small dollar banking. That's accessible to everybody. And so I love that idea. And then I think you kind of get into some goals of, you know, like stimulus and such, Blake, with the UBI, where, and this is one of the things I love about the UBI, is I think it just gives people a lot more flexibility in their lives to take risks that will ultimately work out for them. One of the best definitions of privilege I ever heard was how many second chances you get in life, which I love. And like, you know, I look at myself, I got a degree and then was like, oh my God, I don't know if this is going to work. And I had the privilege to go back to school and get basically a redo, you know? And I think the UBI would give so many people that second chance to say, I'm going to go to school and work part time, or I'm going to take a risk and start a business and I can, you know, survive off the UBI. And I think as you run through that over time, you end up with a much better society. And so I think it ends up becoming a great stimulus for our economy over time, because it gives individuals more flexibility to, you know, go out and stimulate their own economic lives.
Yeah, it really opens up a lot. And it, in ways that we can't even probably comprehend, just the three of us. Yeah.
Plus, we're not in the prediction game anymore. At least I've heard that.
Boo.
Right, so, Kelly, then, what's your policy?
Okay, so I'm up now, and I found out about this just before we started, so I'm coming in a little bit colder, but I think what I would like to see is a version of the Green New Deal be put into place as a policy consideration for a presidential candidate for a couple reasons. Because I think that... So I'll start at first with the fact that I think that we're in a crisis moment as a country with COVID, and I think it presents an opportunity to allow us to move the needle, so to speak, in terms of how we deal with our environmental legislation and how we deal with how our economy will need to change in order to truly approach what a full Green New Deal would be able to accomplish. But what I would like to see in terms of reaction to the COVID crisis is some clear outlines to change subsidies away from fossil fuels towards more greener industries. I think this would help with the economic downturn that is already occurring and likely to occur over the next 3 to 4 months at least. It would, similar to when the first New Deal actually happened in this country, you would have the opportunity to federally sponsor people to get back to work, stimulate the economy, and teach them new skills that could work once the economy is back in a full uptake. If they're in new, greener industries, could help stimulate the economy. It also allows people to be working, producing things that help more than one person in the country, helps the entire society, and gives them job skills that they might need in the future. It doesn't do as much specifically to fight the current epidemic, but I think that in the long run, what it would do is it would help put in government institutions that could help if something like this happened again in the future. But that's kind of more of a side note in terms of preparedness.
Well, can we pause on that real quick?
Yeah.
That's one thing I've been thinking about through this whole experience has been, I feel like this is just a dress rehearsal for some of the terrible effects of global warming that are going to come at us in the next several decades. And you're seeing how the globe is going to respond to something similar to that. And there's scary shit. There's like scary diseases in the permafrost of Russia, and they're melting, and like, you know, that's a fucking thing, which scares the fuck out of me. So maybe that happens. But I think that you see, I want to like give that point more credit, Kelly, is what I'm trying to say. Like, I think that there's like a this is going to tell us, this is the dress rehearsal for a lot of those issues. And so dealing with, and mine is also going to deal with like, not necessarily the crisis itself, but how we get out of it, or how we deal with the aftermath And I think that's kind of what you're talking about too, is.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's
going to, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
It's going to make us more resilient for the next one.
Right. And I mean, I think that any policy that is focused just on response on the ground today doesn't do it good enough justice for the type of crisis we're looking at. Cause you're right. It is, I think in a way it is a dress rehearsal. It is very serious in its own right, but it's a harbinger of potentially things to come.
Yeah.
Right. So if you look at aspects of the Green New Deal where you change parts of the US economy that are based around fossil fuels and basically unlimited use of resources that we can't continue to maintain, and we use this moment where you have millions of people without a job, millions of people, tens of millions of people questioning where they're going to get their next paycheck, how are they going to develop a business when they come out of this, it's an opportunity. It's a golden opportunity to think about those types of things, about how we could really change the entire economy for the better. And if you use the model similar to what I was talking about with the original New Deal during the Depression, where you put people back to work, you give them skills, it isn't necessarily just a handout to stimulate the economy, but you're doing long-term work to better communities and to better people's ability to work afterwards. To me, it seems like a natural win-win all around. So that's what I'd like to see. I will like to say just one thing. Since I didn't know exactly we were going to be doing this, I didn't think as much about medical responses, and I don't know if John's going to get into that a little bit. He might.
So one we should do is we should decouple health insurance and employment. The crazy fucking thing that we do in this country. It's a stupid vestige of World War II. The reason that we do that as a country is because we had wage freezes in World War II. And so one of the only ways that companies could compete with each other for hiring skilled labor is they would offer benefit packages to each other. And that's how we ended up with employment being tied to health insurance. And it's a stupid way of doing it. It's a terribly stupid way and really inhumane way of running a country.
Plus, there wasn't really health insurance.
Yeah, that's then.
Before World War II, that wasn't. It's like you walk down the street. We're not saying that we should necessarily go back to the days where you could pay your barber $2 and he'd pull teeth for you. That wasn't necessarily sanitary.
I mean,
but you know,
the logical progression of that is a single payer national health care.
Right. Yeah.
I think we have, and we saw this in 2008. We saw this. We're seeing this now. We have this very, very annoying habit in America of socializing risk and failure and privatizing reward and profit. And so what that means is Boeing makes stupid fucking decisions with their company, which is not having a vast cash reserve, but doing stock buybacks and CEO bonuses. And so they made bad decisions as a company. And then this happens and they're like, oh, we're an essential company, so bail our shit out. And then the taxpayer, are going to do that. And then we're not going to see the requisite profit of our investment, very likely. And so that is a very frustrating and very annoying thing. And so what that means is something like, and this actually happened with the automotive industry, is the U.S. government bought a part of the company. And then we divested of that company when the Ford and whatever was ready to go. And I believe that we made money off of that, but I don't think that's what we're doing now. And we didn't do that with like financial institutions. We did that with the automotive industry, but not financial institutions. Some of those people.
Yeah. I mean, financial institutions is an entirely different beast. That's way too complicated to get into right now, but no. We were not making money off of our investments back to bail the banks.
So I would very much like to see a more socialization of the rewards or privatization of the risk. We need to just balance one of the. We need to make a decision about that. But I'm tired of funding CEOs who make bad decisions with their companies.
Indeed.
I would like to see Michael Bennett has a great plan that. Basically, the intuition of this is that parenting is labor. Parenting is really fucking hard. and it's really fucking important for the future of the country, so we should pay parents to be parents. So basically you get a child credit. It's like a UBI for children. So you would get $300 per, you know, up to like six kids or something like that. I think that makes a ton of sense. And one of the things that's really advantageous about that is it is profoundly meaningful for parents who are living in poverty, and you have all sorts of vast benefits to society when you get kids out of poverty.
And I'd just like to add to that point that those 43 to 51% of businesses that aren't going to make it in the next 6 months, your child care provider services fall under those businesses.
100%. Yeah. Oh yeah. So. I love that idea, John. I think it's a great idea to do that. It boosts, parents are going to spend that money on their children. Most will. I mean, I'm not going to make a blanket statement. There's bad parents, just like there's bad people. But I mean, I think in general, most people would agree that most parents would do the right thing, which is investing that money back in their children. It means they're going to put more into the economy. They're going to buy more in terms of stuff that's produced for kids. But it's also going to mean that the kid has a better future, likely going to be a better participant in society when they reach the age of being able to work, vote, and give back to society. It's a long-term plan to make everybody better, right? If the idea is that we're Americans and we all deserve a chance to pursue life, liberty, and happiness, that's a great way to do it.
And $300 a month, which is not that much money, is going to mean the difference for a lot of children between jail and starting a business eventually. When you invest that young, you have that divergent of outcomes. And so over 30, 40 years, the amount of money that society makes on that is outrageous when you compare, oh, I have to, you know, this person is in jail literally being a drain on society, or this person started a business that, you know, employs 10 of his neighbors.
And hopefully we're not bailing out, but, you know.
Well, yeah, but I'm okay with bailing out, you know, companies of 10. I'm not okay with bailing out Boeing. That's, you know, the difference there.
Hey, Boeing.
But I have.
The CEO of Boeing was a little child once too, John. So
he was. But so was Voldemort. So, you know.
All right. Yeah.
So, anyways, I have a policy that is near and dear to my heart that is my number one.
I was going
to
ask what your number one or favorite is.
Yeah, no, I haven't gotten there yet. So, one of the interesting effects of World War II is that you had groups of people together that had not been together. Obviously, we had segregated military still at that point. But you had, you know, like fucking people from the South together with people from Brooklyn. And that ended up being a way to stitch together a national fabric. And so I would love to see some way to do that in this country. I think it's extremely important that we remember that we're all Americans, and we haven't done that in the last 4 years, I think.
So, are you proposing mandatory service in Space Force? Is that what you're saying?
I volunteer for Space Force. no. Another thing that particularly concerns me, you know, we graduated into the Great Recession, which was absolutely no fun for any of us.
You didn't enjoy that? Come on.
No, I did not enjoy my 6 months of paying to be in an internship. no. And so, you know, looking at seniors today, seniors in high school, seniors in college, I'm worried about them because this is basically slow motion 9/11 plus the Great Recession. And so,
like, yeah, we're potentially on the precipice of like a Great Depression, potentially.
Yes, and it is very scary, because you can potentially set them back for their life if you do not, because there's a growth curve to people's careers.
I mean, and so and it's already proven that people who graduated in and around the 2008 recession, even up to 5 years later, are probably somewhere in the range of $10,000 to $20,000 less in lifetime earnings than people that came directly a couple years before them or afterwards. And that's a big thing. That's a big amount of money.
That can be a down payment in some places.
Yeah.
You know, maybe not ever, but some places.
Yep.
And so coupled with that, you know, we're going to need to not only figure out jobs for these people, but we're going to need to figure out ways to maintain their skills and build those life skills and those economic skills. Another thing is there's going to be damage after this. There's going to be like shit that just needs to get done, basically. There's going to be shit that like medical care that needs to be done. Helping out orphans, helping out people who can no longer care for themselves. A lot of these things, there's just a lot of jobs that are going to need to get done that are not necessarily like the most economic advantageous jobs. But they might be good for, you know, 20-year-olds, right? So what I would love to see is a national service program. A national service program that is comprehensive. It is not, you know, like go to the military. It is, if you want to go be an EMT, we're going to train you to go be an EMT. If you want to go be a teacher, we're going to train you to go be a teacher. You want to be in the military, be in the military. If you want to be a firefighter, we'll throw you on a line out in wildfire, whatever.
Is this a mandatory or a suggestion?
No.
Where does your policy land on the mandatory?
It would be heavily incentivized. Sticks, but a whole lot of carrots.
Sure.
Because
what it sounds like is that you're combining a bunch of national nonprofits that already do that kind of work into a federally funded program
program. So like let's take, you know, Teach for America, AmeriCorps, and all of those, let's throw it into you know, like a much more robust national agency, and then you have a lot of, you know, you would want to do a major national basically marketing event or campaign that was partnered with every private institution you could possibly get to private with this or get to partner with this, and you make it a really big deal. So you throw a lot of cultural and political capital behind it, and then you also like you pay them, you know, like you literally give these people jobs. It is a jobs program on top of that, at least to get us out of COVID depression, whatever the fuck that looks like. And then we can sunset that program, let's say, in 5 or 10 years, and then we can revisit it. But yeah, you're trying to do the best you can to get as many people into the national service program as you possibly can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like it. It's very similar to what I proposed, but just a little bit wider in terms of the different types of services that I think could be provided by people. But in the end, whether it's through the lens of like a New Deal or through the like Green New Deal or through the lens of a service program, it really means the same thing. And that's battling the current economic crisis that'll happen because of COVID, preparing people for future economic success and stimulating the economy now.
Mm-hmm.
I like it. Yeah.
All good ideas.
All right.
I also want to just say that I put the word infrastructure really large in my notes and put big, bold border around it. I don't have much more to say other than I love infrastructure and we should really invest in it.
It was part of Roosevelt's New Deal.
Let's get high-speed rail on the Front Range and then maybe from DIA into the mountains. Let's get that going. Huh? Anybody?
I would prefer along the Front Range first, just in terms
sequence that shit.
Yeah. I don't necessarily like the idea of high speed rail directly from DIA into the high country for environmental reasons, but that can be another debate on another podcast.
What if instead of high speed we created the low speed luxury train, which is
that already
five
exists.
Five times more wide than your standard train.
Oh, I see.
and operates at a fraction of the speed because there's so much infrastructure on the moving system, and it's just a rotating, structure throughout the entire state that eventually gets you into the mountains and eventually gets you back into the city, and you don't even have to leave the cafe.
That
sounds complicated.
Wasn't there a movie about that by like Guillermo del Toro like a year or two ago? It's a bunch of giant cities driving around fighting each other. That's what it sounds like to me. Sounds like you're proposing a Hollywood movie that I've seen. Well, actually, I didn't see that movie. Never mind.
It'd just be a leisure way to get back and forth, you know? Leisurely way.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah. You said, isn't there a movie about that? I was like, The Polar Express?
Oh, yes, it's a magical
train. That's the only movie I could think of that has to do with a train.
I think it's like Lovely Bodies, Heavenly Bodies or something. I don't know. Something
on that note, listeners, leave us.
There's the murder one where everybody did it. The Orient Express. Isn't it the Murder on the Orient Express?
Yes.
Is that what it's called?
Yes.
That's a book, and then they turned it into a movie. Sorry if I spoiled that for anybody. I'm not actually sure if that's the ending. I'm just almost positive that's
cut.
The ending from
cut.
Social
Clues. Cut.
Godspeed, everybody.
We should redo that ending.
All right, listeners, Blake, you should at least leave us your best train movie in the form of a review on iTunes or Pandora or Spotify or whatever you're listening to.
Are we on Pandora?
No, I don't know why. Okay. Cut.